The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Three Guys with Beards.
The Project Entertainment Network store, featuring t-shirts, mugs, stickers, hoodies, and more from your favorite Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Ink Stains, Scribbler's Rest.
The Horror Show with Brian Keane.
Why not show your loyalty by wearing a cool product from the podcast group and show off to your friends?
It Cooks.
Armcast.
The Mondo Method.
Monster Attack.
Necrocastical.
Go to projectentertainmentnetwork.com and click on the store tab for more details.
The Liars Club Podcast.
Bizarre.
The Lunch Ladies Book Club.
Matters of Faith.
The Project Entertainment Network Store. Stacked with stuff from the best podcasts on the internet.
The Curtain Jerkers.
Buttercup of Doom.
www.projectentertainmentnetwork.com.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemies that modern man has never fought.
Have every not realized war in a game of Stellarium Radiance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Hey everybody, welcome to Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies, and we have certainly had a blast this season, our third season with you guys on Project Entertainment Network, and we are still in the mid to late 50s. I'll tell you, it's amazing how many movies were made during this time period, and we're 1957, our film today, 1957. And in the spotlight for us is an actor that we have talked about quite a bit on Monster Attack, and we've got some more of his films coming your way in future shows, and that is John Agar. I think anybody my age or from my generation that grew up with the old Monster Movie Matinee shows and seeing a lot of these movies that came out in the 50s and early 60s, remember John Agar quite a bit. He was in so many of these films. And an interesting guy. Now, for those of you that haven't heard some of the previous shows that we've done involving John Agar, he was a war hero. He was a sergeant in World War II, highly decorated. And when he came back to the States after the war, he became friends with John Wayne, who got him into the acting business and did some westerns with John Wayne, did some war pictures and that sort of thing, and became a staple in science fictions and monster movies and things of that nature. And later in his life, just before he died, in several interviews, John Agar was heard to say that he did not mind having a reputation for doing B pictures and doing the old science fictions and monster movies that he did because he enjoyed doing it. And he said people enjoyed watching him do it. So he had no problems at all and couldn't understand why people, some people in the industry, would be so critical of him for doing these kind of movies. And I got to say, he was a favorite of mine growing up. We saw him, he became a very, very familiar face. And of course, the maternal side of my family is named Agar. And I don't think we are of the same Agar clan from Ireland, but my genealogy has always tried to see if we linked up with John Agar somehow. His family, if I'm not mistaken, came into Minnesota or the Chicago area, and then I think later into Minnesota. My family came in through Ellis Island and pretty much stayed in New York and the Massachusetts area. But it would be pretty wild if I found out that I was somehow a distant relative of John Agar. Again, you know, you may knock him for his acting style. I mean, John Agar is John Agar, and he's one that he brings the character to himself, and he's like the Duke. He's like John Wayne, where, you know, if his persona fits the character, then it works pretty good. And it works okay in this film. Again, this is a very, very low-budget film. $58,000 is what this film was shot on, and Agar was definitely their big star. It's one of those, I want to call it sort of a guilty pleasure. It's one of those movies that as a kid I really liked. And it was on quite a bit. Monster Movie Matinee used to run this at least a couple of times a year. And there was just something about this movie. It was so cheesy and so cheaply made. There was just something fun about it. We're going to talk about, when we get into the timeline and the storyline of this movie, what some of those things were, why as a kid I found it so much fun, and looked forward to seeing this film. There's a couple of key scenes in this movie that I think anyone who grew up with this movie will remember. So let's talk about the movie a little bit more and some of the people that are involved with it. It's directed by a man who's listed as Nathan Hurst. Now, for those of you that are accustomed to watching a lot of films and television from the 50s, you're going to think, I don't know of a guy named Nathan Hurst. Well, there was no Nathan Hurst in the film industry. This was Nathan Jurin. And Nathan Jurin is a name you might recognize because he did a lot of TV. He did the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. That was probably his signature film as a director. And he ended up directing our movie tonight, The Brain from Planet Aris. And he was so embarrassed by how low the budget was and how cheap the effects were in this. And again, they did pretty good for the amount of money they had. I thought they did a pretty good job of doing what they did with this film. But Nathan was so embarrassed by it that he insisted that they list him as Nathan Hurst. Happens a lot in Hollywood. Of course, most of you who are film fans will know this story, that anytime you see a movie and the director is Alan Smithy, that means it's a well-known director who was too ashamed of the product to have his real name used. So that's always been, and it's not really like a running gag. This is what directors actually did. If they just didn't want their name associated with a movie project, then they went by Alan Smithy. So that's sort of what Nathan did here. He just had them change his last name, so hopefully nobody would mistake him for Nathan Jurin. Now, let's get into the rest of our cast. You're going to see some familiar faces in this movie, but again, playing the character of Steve March, John Agar. He's your big guy. This is the big honcho that they got for this film. And again, you know, John was always a very competent actor. And, you know, a lot of the criticisms I think he got from critics that looked at movies and things like that were the types of movies he did, not so much his acting style. He's a little wooden, he's a little stiff, but again, he had a persona on screen that worked and was very appealing. And especially to those of us who were kids, he was in a lot of our favorite films. You know, I talked about him a lot in The Daughter of Dr. Jekyll. That's the first time I saw John Agar in a movie at all. And then, of course, he was in some classic films like Sands of Iwo Jima and some other military films from the World War II age. And he was just very competent. The last film I remember seeing John Agar in, and a lot of you will remember this, was the remake of King Kong, the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong film. And that was where John played the mayor of New York. He's the one that ordered the helicopters to take down Kong. Now, his female co-star, who plays a character by the name of Sally, is Joyce Meadows. Interesting gal. And this gal is gorgeous. Very, very pretty lady. Very attractive. Yes, as a kid, very attracted to her. I won't say I totally fell in love with her because I didn't see her enough. But she was in a little bit of TV and some movies. And sometimes she is confused as being the sister of Jane Meadows, who appeared in the Honeymooners. The different Meadows. There was Audrey Meadows and Jane Meadows, and they did a lot of TV and ended up appearing on a lot of panel shows and game shows. But Joyce has no relation to them whatsoever. And she did a few things here and there, but really had sort of a career that was not significant as far as people may not recognize her from a lot of the things that she did. Did a lot of B pictures. She did a lot of films that probably ended up on the drive-in circuit, and she did a lot of TV. Now, she's still with us, and her last acting role was on a TV series called Dream On, if you might remember that, from the 1990s. I mean, she appeared on shows during those at that time, where Lois and Clark and some others like that, and she does still do the convention circuit. She's still with us. She's 84 years old. And was actually one of the guests at this year's Monster Bash convention in Pennsylvania. So you could still run up on Joyce Meadows. And I would really like to cross paths with her simply because of this film. Because Brain from Planet Aris has become sort of her signature film. And she's very good at it. Like I said, she's very attractive. And she's just got a wonderful girl next door type quality to her. And that was one of the nice things I remember growing up about Brain from Planet Aris. It's like, boy, that John Agar fellow, he's pretty lucky because, you know, this is his fiance in the movie. So you've got Steve Marsh and Sally Fallon. These are your two leads in The Brain. Now, we've got a brief appearance by an actor by the name of Robert Fuller. Again, Robert Fuller was another actor who did a lot of TV work and some low-budget films. He plays a character by the name of Dan Murphy. Dan gets killed. Oh, yeah, I should say. Well, I just spoiled it, didn't I, if you haven't seen this movie. Yeah, this is, 61-year spoiler alert. Dan Murphy gets killed pretty early in this film, and the character of Dan Murphy is Steve March's assistant. Now, Steve March is supposed to be a big nuclear scientist. Oh, my goodness, 1957, and I just mentioned that word. Yes, folks, as we discussed with X the Unknown last week, and virtually every film from this time period that was made in the United States or Great Britain, we are again dealing with the fear and the paranoia of nuclear weapons, nuclear technology, and the impact that that nuclear radiation can have on mankind. And that paranoia works itself into this as well. The movie opens up, in fact, with Steve getting these strange readings from a mountain that's about 30 miles away and can't explain it. Let's go over quickly a couple of the other people that you're going to see in this film, and one who is a very, very popular monster movie and more probably science fiction than monster movie, and that's Thomas B. Henry or Thomas Brown Henry. He appears under both names. He was in, I think the last time we talked about Thomas was probably in Earth versus the Flying Saucers. He always plays a general or some high-up military guy. In this, though, he doesn't. He plays a little bit different character. He plays Sally's father, who is somehow involved in the scientific world like Steve is, but his role is never clearly defined. But you get the idea that they both work for similar projects. Steve is working under a government grant and studying nuclear anomalies and things of that nature. So these are your main players right here, and they are going to hold up most of this film. It's a short film. It's only 71 minutes long, and it opens up with Steve in his laboratory, and they're out in the middle of the desert, and of course, all of the nuclear tests and things of that nature occurred out in the desert, so you would find laboratories and research facilities of this nature, out there. And it's one of those where, he lives in his facility. So, that, it's basically more than a house that's got a home laboratory in it. And he's studying the Geiger counter, and he gets with Dan and says, look, there's something strange going on here. I'm getting this burst of gamma radiation. It's not happening all the time. It's coming, it's coming in spurts. No reason it should. Of course, Dan is like, well, maybe it's from the sun, maybe it's this. And Steve says, no, I've ruled all of that out. It's not that. It's coming. He says, I've tracked it to Mystery Mountain. Well, that's going to be fun. Because in the beginning of this film, as we're seeing the opening credits, we see this beam of light, and we don't really know what it is, but then it results in this big explosion around this mountain. So now we're thinking, okay, that must be Mystery Mountain. So something weird's going on, some kind of UFO activity or something of that nature. Well, Steve tells Dan, he says, we got to go out there and check it out. And of course, it's like, go out there in this time, this time of the year, it's obviously the summertime from the way they're talking, because temperatures could get up to 120 degrees. But he says, we got to go out and find out what this is. This is very significant. And they take all their equipment and get ready to head out. Not before they have lunch first with Sally and her father, John. So as we continue on with our storyline, we see Steve and Dan, they're in a Jeep and they can only go so far. They get up so far into this mountain range, and they have to stop and go on foot, and they hike down off of the peak that they were able to drive up on, because they see a cave down there that they can't explain. And Dan and Steve both say, I don't remember a cave being there, and it looks like somebody is just carved it right out, in the last few weeks. They can't understand what kind of machinery would be able to do that quickly. So they go investigate the cave. And while they're in the cave, they become aware of the fact that someone else is in there with them, because they see these this weird glowing light that keeps showing up down a couple of the passageways in this cave. A couple are dead ends, but then they get to this one and where this big glow had shown up and there's nobody there. Can't figure out what's going on. And then all of a sudden, they both turn, they see this thing. And this is when we first see our monster in the movie. And this is the brain from Planet Aras. And it looks like a big sort of translucent brain with two eyes sort of in the front. Just sort of these glowing lights that look sort of like eyes. And it's hovering there next to him. Of course, they try to shoot it. And Steve says, we've got to get by this thing. And he empties his pistol into it and runs and all of a sudden, you know, falls down in absolute agony and passes out. And then Dan has a M1 carbine and he empties his clip into it. And then he also, in this brilliant light that lights him up, collapses. And we assume that both are dead, that they both may be killed because of this. Although we know, and watching the movie that, hey, you know John Agar's character's not dead because he's the star of the movie. And they're not going to kill him off in the first 10 minutes of the movie. Well, we understand from a conversation that Sally has with her father that Steve and Dan have been gone for a week. And she's very, very worried about them. And about the time she's about ready to ask her father tells her father on the phone that she's going to go out there, Steve shows up. He just shows up and he says, hey, the prodigal son returns. And there's something not quite right about him. And she picks up on something that Steve is a little different. We're not sure what it is, but he slips in and out. He becomes a little aggressive. And then he seems to be old Steve. And then, of course, you know, we do learn that they are, you know, fiancé. You know, they're slated to get married. She's his fiancé. And they, of course, go into the usual kissing because he's been gone a long time. She makes a comment, wow, you've never kissed me like that before. And that develops into more and more and more. And then it becomes almost a rape scene. Now, I'm trying to think if that scene made it into the early television prints of this film because I really don't remember that as a kid. And it gets a little testy because he tears her blouse. You can see her bra underneath and it really is the closest thing that in those days they could show to a rape scene on a movie that was made for $58,000. And of course, she's able to push him away and he takes off. And of course, now we're left that, yeah, there is something weird going on here. This guy is different. And this is now set the table for our brain from Planet Aras. We find out he's power hungry. He's evil. And he wants to not only take over the world, but take what he gets from planet Earth and take that back to planet Aras and take them over and become the master of all of the universe. So there's your story, and it's laid out very, very quickly. Well, Sally is very, very concerned and gets back with her father and says something is wrong with him. He's not right. And so they go out to Mystery Mountain. They end up going out to Mystery Mountain, and they find Dan's body out there. And they also find something else. In the cave near where Dan is, the brain shows up, and we're all thinking, oh, no, no, they're going to get it too. But we find out this is a good brain. And the brain's name is Ball. Now, the bad brain's name is Gore. But Ball says, no, no, I don't mean you any harm. And he said, there's this other creature from my planet. I'm sent here to try to get him and bring him back. He's evil. He escaped, and he will harm your planet, and you need to meet with me tonight at 8 o'clock, and I will explain everything to you at your house. And they do. Now, we know that Gore wants power. We have a little scene here where Gore has it, you know, goes in and out of Steve quite a bit. He will pop out and then pop back into him. And, of course, they use this vehicle as a way to explain what he wants from the planet Earth and from the universe. Now, Sally is talking with her dad, and it's at that time that Baal shows up and explains everything to her as far as what is going on, what Gore wants, and all of that. And they come to a decision. And again, folks, I'm skipping over a lot of this because it is sort of a fun movie to watch. Ball says, I need to inherit, possess someone's body so that I can keep an eye on Gore, so that I can catch him in his natural state so we can capture him and take him back to planet Aris. I need to be in a body that is not going to be, too obvious, that will blend in. And of course, Sally says, use me, because Baal says, frankly, if I can't get Gore out of that body and capture him that way, then Steve is going to have to give up his life. He's going to have to kill himself. It's the only way that we would be able to stop Gore from his evil quest to take over. But they decide on the perfect place that they can have a Baal hide out, and that's in George. Yeah, they can do it in George. Because we find out that Steve is making arrangements to meet up with the military for some atomic bomb tests that they're going to be having that weekend. And of course, we know that he also tells Sally the next time that they meet, he says, I got a surprise for him. Oh, I'm going to show him something that they're not going to believe. I'm going to really surprise him. And he talks about, that they're going to have power and they're going to be rich and all of that. Now, before he tells Sally all of this, and when he was on his way to pick her up, this is one of the downsides of the budget for this movie, because the effects are really bad. Now, I mean, the brains are okay. It's a superimposition. That's why they're sort of translucent. But we have a scene where we get a chance to see Gore's power using Steve when a plane is flying overhead, and he's out in the desert getting ready to go over to Sally's home. And he looks up, and all of a sudden his eyes turn all black, and boom, the plane explodes. And, total disaster. It's basically a model airplane on a string. It's clearly on a string. It doesn't look like a plane flying. And it's sad because it sort of takes away. It's a shame they couldn't have found some stock footage or something and made it work a little better. And not a good choice at all for the special effects on that. It really takes away from the sort of the pathos involved in this storyline. And it's a shame. It hurts the movie a little bit. So Steve is going on and on and on and on and on now with Sally. They're going out for the evening, and basically what that involves is them going out and making out somewhere up in the mountains. He gets a little aggressive again. She fights him off, and he says, and he comes around, and I think this is where Gore is, sort of sneaky. Realizes, whoops, crossed the line here. I better be careful. She's going to suspect something, and says, look, let's just forget about it. I just got carried away. I'm excited about this test coming up that I'm going to go to. And they flip on the radio, and they hear the radio report about this plane crash, and the plane has crashed not far from where they are. In fact, Sally says, hey, we're only about 20 miles away. We ought to go see if they need some help. And he goes, yeah, that's a good idea. And that's when we get to meet the colonel that is conducting the big test that weekend. And obviously Steve has known him for quite a while and probably works under his department or under his division of the military, who is financing the grant that Steve is using to study the effects of radiation. And they're glad he shows up, because they find that all of the bodies that they have recovered from this plane crash, which they can't understand why it blew up, but they're all burned, and it looks like radiation type burns. And so they say, what do you think of this? He says, I don't know. Now, we also find out that the body of Dan has been found. Steve had tried to use a cover story that Dan and he split up after they left Mystery Mountain and that Dan went to Las Vegas. But we know that's not true, because Dan's body is found in the mountains, and he has also been badly burned from what looks like radiation. So they got a real mystery on their hands. They don't know what to make of it. Now, after Steve drops off Sally at home, and her father's there, I get the impression the father lives there with her, and George is there, and so the brain, they're all sort of conspiring on how they can figure out how to get rid of Gore. We find out he's got a weakness. It's a weakness that when he appears in his natural state, this would not be the translucent type state, but the actual state, a physical state, if he is struck on an area of what on the human brain would be the fissure of Rolando, then that would be one way to kill Gore. And that is his only weakness, which Sally and John make a note of. They said this will be something that we could use. Now, While that is going on, Steve is back home and the sheriff shows up. And the sheriff, our sheriff is played by an old-time actor by the name of Tim Graham, showed up. You'll recognize this guy in a heartbeat. He always plays guys like this. Sheriffs are old country guys. He was in Petticoat Junction and other movies of that, you know, and TV shows and stuff like that. He always played something like an old Western guy or old, but usually like a sheriff or something of that nature. And he shows up and he says, yeah, I want to talk to you about your partner, Dan. And he says, yeah, well, he was supposed to be in Las Vegas. And he said, well, no, we found him dead and he was burned. And he says, you know, you lied about Dan, didn't you? You didn't, you know, you left him there and we need to find out what's going on. And of course, Steve goes, you're going to arrest me? And he says, well, I may have to because, you know, the fact that you just lied to us about knowing that Dan was dead and not admitting it, that's a problem. That's a real problem. And Steve goes, no, it's not going to be a problem because I did kill Dan. And then we start seeing his eyes get that black sort of glistening look, which was done with some very, very thick and heavy contact lenses, which John Agar said were very painful and very hard to wear for any length of time. But that is their effect to show that Gore is totally taking him over briefly. And that's when this power that he has comes out. And the sheriff says, he pulls out his gun and says, no, I'm going to have to arrest you. And Steve says, no, I'm going to kill you now. And of course, then all of a sudden the bright light and the sheriff is just burned and dead. And Steve picks him up and throws him into a back part of the laboratory in a corner somewhere where he won't be found. So now this takes us to the big meeting. The big meeting that Steve is going to have with the brass. Now, on his way to take off for Indian Springs, which is the home of the Atomic Energy Commission in that area, this is where the big meeting is going to be held about the atomic bomb blast. We see that the generals had earlier met about the discovery of Dan's body and that it was radiation that obviously burned him. They're discussing the plane crash. And the odd thing about the plane crash was that it looks like it was caused by some kind of radioactive energy, but there's no contamination. The metal shards from the plane and the wreckage is not radioactive. The bodies are not radioactive, so that's the big mystery here. Well, Steve shows up, and they said, yeah, we're going to, he wants to talk to him. And they said, okay, we'll give you 2 minutes to talk to him, but we've got a very important meeting before it finalizes all of these tests. And that's when Steve says, sort of shows his true colors and reveals that he is a creature from another planet. And he says, I have a power beyond anything that you know. And let me show you something here before you do your atomic bomb test. Watch the TV screen. Now, this is using a lot of stock footage that a lot of us have seen in movies of this nature that deal with atomic bomb tests, because it's the footage that was available from the government from the actual atomic bomb tests that they used to conduct in the 50s. So, and in fact, they even used it in the day after, and some of those films. But this time Steve says, watch the TV screen, and there's a big explosion, and then all of the things are wiped out, and the tanks that were there, everything. And he says, I just did that. I did that. And they're absolutely stunned. And he says, and you're going to listen to me because I'm in charge now. And, I'm going to use this power to take over the Earth, and I may let you live, because if you don't do what I say and have these particular people, and basically like the Security Council countries, Russia, Germany, France, some of those, he says, I want representatives from all of those countries here tomorrow night. And if they're not here, then I'm going to wipe out all of their capitals. And I can do that right from here. Well, one of the officers jumps out of nowhere with his .45 and unloads towards Steve, and Steve kills him with the same power, with the same energy that he killed the sheriff, the same energy that he used to blow up the airplane. In fact, he blows up another airplane for these guys just to show them what he is capable of doing. This is after their meeting the next night. Again, like I said, I'm sort of skipping by pretty quickly because, they're stuck. Well, what can they do? They get all of the representatives from the country, different countries that he asked for, and then he shows them and he blows up another plane. And unfortunately, it's another model on a string. And this time it's really bad because when they blow up the plane, if they had cut away the minute that it exploded, I could have almost lived with that. But even as a kid, and I built a lot of monster models as a kid, so, you know, I'm very familiar with how they're made. After the plane blew, you knew it was on a string because a big hunk of the plane comes flying back into the frame, like it would if you blew up a model that was on a string. It wouldn't all blow up. And again, it hurts the film a little bit. It's like, oh, man. But we're getting to the scene that I always remember. So Steve gets back home. He's got what he wanted. He's got these people. Sally is trying to figure a way that she can get Gore into a situation where we can see him in his true form and he'll be vulnerable to an attack, because we are told by Ball that he has to come out of the body and take on his pure form to regenerate himself, or he's going to lose a lot of energy. And that's why, and Steve is like very tired through all of this. Well, when she's there, she leaves a note for Steve that basically is out of an almanac that shows a picture of the brain, and it shows the fissure of Rolando. And she's got a little note in there that says Gore's Achilles heel and an arrow pointing there. She leaves it by Steve's pipes, hoping that he will see it maybe at a time that Gore's not inside of him and will understand what it means and attack Gore. Well, she gets caught there because Steve gets back before she gets completed, and she gets stuck hiding out in the lab when he shows up. And here comes the brain, and Gore comes out of him. And now we see, now this isn't a translucent brain. Now we see a physical prop that's probably on some wires. It's a little bit better than the airplane, but not much. Sort of floating there talking, ha, 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 as a typical evil guy, a little over the top. But Steve does see the note. And about that time, as Sally is trying to conceal herself from Gore and from Steve, so they don't know that she's there, she bumps into the body of the sheriff and screams. And this is the scene I always remember. She's screaming, and also the brain on a beeline makes it for where she is and comes flying around these shelves that she's hiding behind. And I always remember that scene of the big brain coming around and confronting her. I don't know why I liked that as a kid. And it's at the very end of the movie, but that's okay. Steve grabs an axe because there's one next to the fireplace that he used for chopping up firewood into smaller pieces, and he starts nailing Gore with the axe and beating and beating and beating him, and Gore is gone. It has worked, and of course, everything is happily ever after. And George shows up, and Steve is like, how did you know to warn me about this? How did you know about the weakness? And she says, because of the other brain. And he's in George, and he's been following you. And of course, George comes into the house. She says, tell him. But the brain is already gone, back to the planet Arras. And of course, we're left with a little bit of a cutesy ending where it's like, oh, you and your imagination. Ha, ha, ha. Again, a little bit of a cheesy ending. But there is something about this movie as a kid, and I think it was about the big brains floating around or the one attacking the girl at the end, that I will never forget. And I've always enjoyed this movie, Brain from Planet Arras. And this also came out a few years before a couple of other big brain pictures came out as well. So it became sort of a common theme in a lot of monster movies. But again, folks, this one's purely for novelty's sake. Might get a kick out of it. Like I said, it's cheesy. It's very cheaply made, but John Agar and Joyce Meadows and Tom Henry, they do a good job, with what they're given. And of course, any movie that is filmed a good part in the Bronson Caverns, you can't go wrong with that. Our good old Bronson Caverns, big part of Monster Attack, because so many movies were shot there that were shot out on the West Coast. So, The Brain from Planet Arras, 1957. Hey, folks, we've got another special one for you coming your way next week. And Mark Maddox will be joining us very soon, probably within the next 2 weeks. We've got some fun movies we're going to talk about with Mark. We've also got Madeline Brumby coming back, and we're going to continue on with our Creature from the Black Lagoon series here on Monster Attack. And again, as always, we truly appreciate all of the suggestions you send us. We read them all. We try to respond to you to let you know that we've seen your suggestions. And don't be surprised if you don't see some of them show up on Monster Attack shortly after you recommend them. We love hearing from the folks that listen to this show. And we want to remind you folks, occasionally, if you get the chance, to go up to the Project Entertainment Network site and visit the Project Entertainment store. Now, we have sales now and then on T-shirts and some of the things, but if you like Monster Attack and want to get your own personal Monster Attack T-shirt or hoodie, then we have really nice hoodies. We've got socks, we've got pillows, coffee cups, all kinds of that. We've even got protective cases for your cell phones, all kinds of things. Go visit the Project Entertainment Network store and check out some of the cool stuff for not only our show, but all of the other podcasts on Project Entertainment Network. We'll see you next Monday at 5 o'clock for a whole new episode of Monster Attack. You guys have a great week, and thanks for listening.
Scribblers rest. Do you pop D20s like candy? Do you bleed D6s? Then Scribblers Rest is your fix. Do some time with a crew of authors, artists, and other nefarious types. We have a case of dues in the fridge, and plenty of magic missiles to unload into your darkness. Slide us in your ear hole and let us work our magic. Feel our vibes every Thursday on the Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.